This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is June 10th, 2021, and this is episode 243.
I'm Strzok Lindebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we've saved the trees, but we might lose the greens. Politics continues to happen. First, thank you to the 101 people who contribute to the show every month. Thanks especially to Jack and Donald, who upped their pledges recently. Remember, you can always go back if you're a current patron and give us a little more money at patreon.com/politicos. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's kick off our main segment with the continuing situation in Ferry Creek. The forests have been saved, depending on who you ask. The hereditary and elected chiefs of the Huayat, Ditdat, and Pachidat First Nations on Monday called for a two-year deferral of old-growth logging in their territories following internal discussions and consultations and their processes in those nations. And the province granted that, meaning old-growth logging must cease immediately in Ferry Creek and the central Walbran area, which represents about 2,000 hectares of old-growth forest.
So this isn't exactly a surprise that the BC government agreed to this right away. They've been pretty clear in their signaling on this, that they're more or less going to defer to what the local First Nations want to do with respect to these logging decisions. What I was a little surprised about was to see the First Nation bands change their decision on this, just until now, it seemed like they were pretty intent on continuing on with this.
Yeah, to give the full quote from the news release, they said, "This essential work is being carried out. We expect everyone to allow forestry operations approved by our nations and the government of British Columbia and other parts of our territories to continue without interruption. Please respect that our citizens have a constitutionally protected right to benefit economically from our lands, waters, and resources." Like, I think it's a recognition. There's no one in the province, I think, who really thinks long-term we should be chopping down all of the old-growth forests. Like, even if that's most of the resource, all the forestry you have on your territory, I think we all agree and recognize that is not a long-term sustainable thing. And so it's not hugely surprising to me that this statement came out. It is definitely a change of tune from what had been said, but I think it's also a reflection of the, I don't want to say pressure, but like the awareness raising that the protesters have successfully done in getting through and raising that, hey, we should put a pause on these, on this forestry activity, focus on the newer growth stuff, the more sustainable forestry, and go forward in that way. I think it's good to see the government quickly agree to it. It's funny in a way that, funny is not the right word, but it's telling that the government still has to sign off on it. Cabinet has to sign off on it. We do still live in a very colonial country in that way. Like the government, the nations had to ask and the government had to say yes. Now, the government had tied its own hands by saying they were going to respect the sovereignty of Indigenous nations, but they weren't required to.
True. But like you said, they pretty much bought themselves into a corner in terms of their freedom of movement on this issue, both with what's been said in the recent months, but also just the longer-term position they've staked out for, I think, years at this point.
And politically, there'd be absolutely no reason to support continued logging at this point.
Basically, the only group I could see being in support at that point would be there are at least ones that are well-connected with the NDP and that they maybe listen to would be the forestry, I'm not even sure what union it would be, whoever represents the forestry professionals or workers who might want the jobs. That would be about it.
I know Teal Jones, the company, was quick to come out and say they'll respect the deferral request from the nations. We haven't heard much from unions in this entire dispute, which is interesting in its own right.
Yeah, because that's one of the internal pressure points for the NDP is their blue-collar union roots versus the what is now the base of kind of urban professional types who tend to have very different views on resource development.
Nevertheless, the other party in this are the protesters, largely represented by Rainforest Flying Squad, but a lot are very decentralized. It's a very interesting scenario where the big environmental organizations are not really involved in this protest. It's a lot more grassroots and decentralized than a lot. There's a good piece in the Globe and Mail a week or two ago about how, in a way, it was largely all brought together or started, kicked off by a kid in an older teenager in Washington State who was just spending a lot of time on Google Maps identifying old growth forests and encouraging people to get active.
Everyone needs a quarantine hobby.
More power to them. Like any kid who's that engaged politically and that interested, I want to see more of that. But the protesters in this case have said they are going to continue their demonstrations despite the repeated requests now from the First Nations to respect their sovereignty and decisions. Saul Arbus, a member of the Flying Squad, said it's a good deferral. However, it falls short of the deferrals required to pause logging in all of the critically endangered areas currently being defended for generations to come. In other words, there are old growth forests next to Ferry Creek and the Central Walbran area that could still be at risk. And therefore, because of these potential trees, we're going to keep monitoring and keep our blockades going. Which at some point, I feel like you can claim a victory and go home and still be respectful and then be respectful of the wishes of the nations who are saying, we've made this decision. Here's how we want to go about it.
Yeah, this feels like they're very much at risk of overplaying their hand on this. It was one thing when old growth trees were coming down those roads and they were trying to stop that. That, I think, generally at least had some fairly widespread support in a lot of parts of the province. But when it's logging of potential new growth forests or just getting in the way of indigenous people going to and from their homes, it gets a lot less sympathetic real quick.
And it was a little less clear early in the week. I remember when the news was just breaking, it wasn't clear what the deferral would cover. And at that point, there was this question of, will it be sufficient to cover the old growth forest in question? And by the end of the week, and by today on Thursday, it seems pretty clear this will be a pretty substantial deferral, a pretty good protection of those forests. Of course, there are still other old growth forests around the province, and other nations are raising their own concerns. Closer to home here, just outside Metrovan, the Squamish Nation has said just in the last couple of days that they're now opposed to 20 proposed cut blocks around the Howe Sound. Hasalem, a spokesperson for the council, has said they're asking the government to support Squamish management of the lands and resources that rightfully belong to them. He said the government is infringing on our rights by allowing these sites to be logged without our permission and without our consent. And there's a bit of contention over whether the government is dragging its heels on this and not acting as quickly as they did in this case with the Pachidat and Ferry Creek, and the growing number of nations around the province, each having their own processes, some asking for deferrals, some waiting for further engagement. It's a tough situation for the government because this is a very diverse province. There is no one indigenous nation. There are, I think, 140. That's just off the top of my head. There's quite a few. It's a complicated process.
Yeah,
maybe up to 200.
Pardon?
There may be up to 200 First Nations. I just Googled it.
And particularly as the UNDRIP-related laws and case law still developing through, the government seems pretty intent on being pretty cautious on all of this. When it's a clear-cut example, that might not be the right... When it's a very obvious, uncontroversial thing that they've been moving fairly quick, we're there's more potential for complications further down the road. They've taken, I think, a little more of a reserved and cautious approach to it, which is probably the right thing to do from just a risk management point of view for the government.
And a lot of other negotiations are happening. The government announced this week that they'd reached an agreement with the Tahltan central government, the Iskut Band Council, and the Tahltan Band Council for a shared prosperity agreement for those territories in the Golden Triangle area in northern BC. This would essentially hand over, as far as I understand, mining rights to those nations and allow them to work together with the province and the federal government to develop land use policies and resource extraction policies that are in the nation's own interest. So lots of these agreements are being worked on. I'm definitely on going back and forth each day between whether I'm more frustrated with the lack of action or optimistic about some of the announcements that are getting made. And it's not just the government's own caution in this. Many of these nations' internal processes take time, and particularly like we've seen in the Wet'suwet'en conflict decision issues, many of the internal processes are complicated by the fact that the federal government and provincial government's policies over decades in the last 150 years of this country have been to destroy the traditional ways of governing. So rebuilding those internal decision-making processes is a long and slow process that's only just beginning. And as those are rebuilt, there are then more lasting ways to have these nation-to-nation relationships.
Yeah, we also shouldn't gloss over and treat the nations of the monolith either, because there's also going to be probably fairly intense internal disagreements on a lot of these matters too, which is going to take some time to sort out. And they're definitely, from the little bit of my outsider perspective that I can see, like, it does seem there are significant disagreements on how much to proceed with economic development versus continuing to kind of preserve the land as is. And it's an issue that I think every governing body of one type or another has to deal with, and the nations themselves are no different on that.
Yeah, and they will change their minds at different times, as any governing body will. Sometimes they're for logging, and then the will changes, and then they're against it. And that is allowed when you are a sovereign entity.
And yeah, it's...
To come back to the Squamish Nation, they're saying this week, and I respect that, they're worried about old growth logging in around Howe Sound. It's also a nation that has a pretty promising partnership with the Woodfibre LNG project that's going to be under construction soon.
Yeah, that's a really good point there. And there's definitely a tendency in kind of left and progressive circles to, I think, treat the indigenous peoples as a proxy group or a monolith that is in support of kind of the broader views on environmental issues that seems to range from opportunistic to a little paternalistic at times. I think it is really important for us to remind people that is just not the case. And a clear example of that is the Woodfibre LNG, as well as the logging that has now recently ceased in Fairy Creek.
I, for one, am hopeful that this leads to a de-escalation of tensions, a bit more calm and cooler heads in the near future, and that the standoffs are reduced and we can start to see a path forward.
Moving on to our second segment, Crossing the Floor Differently. One that does see a path forward and a new one is MP, formerly of the Green Party, Jenica Atwin, who announced today that she is no longer a member of the Green Party and has crossed the floor to join the Liberals, which took everyone by surprise. Particularly the second part.
Including Annamie Paul, the leader of the Green Party, who apparently only learned of this from media reports today. I will note that the news was leaked before Atwin herself was able to spread it. I think I saw at least one or two different sources on Twitter starting to tweet out. I think it was the Toronto Star first, I want to say, that they were hearing rumors that she was going to be crossing the floor. I don't know when it formally happens, but her Wikipedia page has already been updated.
The Liberals have put out a welcome Jenica Atwin post already, so maybe there's some paperwork to fill out, but it's as close to official as it needs to be, I think, for most practical purposes.
Tomorrow's sitting, she'll be on the other side of the bench. Atwin's an interesting MP. She was the first person in New Brunswick to be elected who was neither a liberal or conservative. And I say conservative meaning current conservative, progressive conservative, old conservative, or Tory of the day. That province has only ever returned a red or a blue member of parliament until Atwin won in 2019 as one of the green wave of three MPs, as it were.
It was a bit of a wave. Yeah, when I lived in that riding, it was between elections, but yeah, it was a conservative that represented it. And now it went green, and I guess it's back to liberal. And I guess from what I know of New Brunswick politics, Fredericton's probably the most friendly part of the province for that kind of non-traditional party to get traction in. But even that, it was a bit of a slog. You were looking at the past election prior to that, and the Greens threw a lot of money into that riding.
In 2015, it looks like they spent $159,000, and I was trying to verify that on Elections Canada, because that is $70,000. That is $60,000 more than the Liberals spent to win it.
Yeah, that's a hugely disproportionate share for a party that then only ended up netting little over 12% of the vote. So I guess it goes to show that money isn't everything in politics, and that kind of tends to get overemphasized a bit, but I'm sure we'll talk about that later in the podcast.
Yeah, in 2019, Atwin spent $55,000. The Liberals spent $82,000, according to Wikipedia. They don't have the conservative number, but Atwin took 33.7% of the vote, the Conservatives 30.4%, and the Liberals 27.5%, roughly. The NDP got a meager 6% of the vote, which was down from the 10% they got the previous election. New Brunswick's never been that fertile ground for the New Democrats, even provincially. The Greens, though, have been on the upswing, and they actually did a pretty healthy showing in one of the last New Brunswick elections. I can't remember which one.
So they had, if I recall, they had an election this past year where what was a PC minority government got bumped up to a majority. But in the election prior to that, which had been not that long after our 2017 election, they ended up in one of those weird hung parliaments where the Liberals and PCs were tied, and then the Greens had three seats and the
People's Alliance,
essentially,
I
can't recall the party name, but a populist right party also had three seats, which made the whole thing even more delightfully uncertain than our 2017 post-election time.
They made it work for a while, though. But coming back to Atwin, she's interesting for that reason, that she was a unique breakthrough in New Brunswick, but she's also like a pretty talented and by all accounts well-respected parliamentarian. She ran on, I don't know if she ever identified as the eco-socialist side of the Green, but that more fiscally progressive side of the Greens. She has an Indigenous heritage. I don't know if she fully identifies that way. I think she is married to someone who is a Indigenous chief, I believe. So there's a lot of passion on environmental reconciliation issues for Atwin, which she claims is why she's supportive of going to the Liberals now, because she argues that the pandemic has moved the Liberals from where she was more critical of them in the past. Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, that's a claim that I don't entirely agree with. But
the Liberals are a more likely place to win re-election in Fredericton than the NDP.
True.
So maybe there's some crass political opportunism there, or calculus, but let's get into how she decided to leave the party, because the Greens have not had, at the federal level, a good month. Let's say a little over a month.
It's been particularly bad in the last month, but in all honesty, I think the problems really started shortly after Annamie Paul became leader, and it was pretty clear from a couple weeks after the vote that there was the internal party apparatus was not entirely on board with doing what the new leader necessarily wanted to do. And that's lingered on for a while. And a lot of that seems to be that the party was really built around Elizabeth May. And that means a lot of kind of the apparatus parts are very much in kind of Elizabeth May's mold, which is not necessarily the mold of Annamie Paul.
And that alone is an interesting tension, because in the leadership race, Paul was largely seen as the heir successor to May. I don't know if she was formally endorsed by May. I don't think May went that far, but there was this idea that if you liked where Elizabeth May had taken the party, Annamie Paul was the continuity candidate, versus Dimitri Lascaris was the eco-socialist, go more radical kind of swing. And so within the Greens, you had a number of stories, especially over the fall and spring, about tensions with the advisors. And a lot of that really came to a public boil during the latest hostilities in Israel and the attacks on Palestine and the rockets from Hamas at Israel. And during this back and forth, Jenica Atwin and Paul Manley were tweeting pro-Palestinian statements in solidarity. For example, on May 11th, Atwin tweeted, "I stand with Palestine and condemn the unthinkable airstrikes in Gaza and the apartheid." And this was later followed up on May 14th by Green advisor Noah Zatzman, who expressed solidarity with Israel in some Facebook posts. And he went on to accuse politicians, including Green MPs, who he did not name, of bigotry and anti-Semitism, which is quite the thing for an advisor to do publicly.
Yeah, Canadian parties particularly are very tight-lipped and disciplined. It's the Greens, so not really most of the time. But even so, when was the last time before that you heard of a non-elected Green making waves? A non-elected Green with a formal role in the party making serious waves against an elected member.
And they only have three MPs, and Elizabeth May has generally been seen to be more on the
supportive of Israel side.
Pro-Israel side. And so Zatzman's comments were pretty clearly referencing out. They only have three MPs. Who he's talking about?
Yeah. So Paul Manley's the most obvious person who would be the target of that, because it's worth remembering he was denied the ability to run with the NDP at one point over his position on the issue, among other reasons. And I think that's where most people went immediately when the unnamed MPs were in that tweet. But given the context you mentioned earlier with those tweets, it's also clear that covered off or had the potential to also be referred to Atwin.
So there was that element of it. And then after that back and forth and exchange of Facebook posts and tweets went around, eventually the Green Party Council decided not to renew Zatzman's contract because he had been partially employed by the party. On the other hand, he was also an advisor to Annamie Paul as leader, and it's unclear if she has retained him. She has not said whether she has terminated his contract or not, which leads me to suspect she hasn't and has kept him around, which means you have MPs who are at odds with the leader of the party.
Yeah, the only other thing I could see being a factor there is not wanting to potentially alienate voters that are more Israeli aligned in their views on the issue, and trying to keep that out of the headlines. It's not out of the realm of possibility that it could have been a quiet letting go and moving on. The fact that there seems to be still tensions in the party, I think, suggests that's a much less likely scenario, but it's, like I said, not out of the question that could have happened.
So Paul denied that Zatzman's statements had anything to do with Atwin's departure. She says that Atwin had been talking to the liberals for weeks, as was also leaked today by liberal insiders. But a statement came out from Paul Manley and Green. A statement came out today from Elizabeth May and Paul Manley as the elected Green caucus. And they said, unfortunately, the attacks against Ms. Atwin by the Green Party's leader's chief spokesperson on May 14th created the conditions that led to the crisis. So they blame Zatzman directly. They added that they're frustrated with the state of the Green Party, but have, quote, no intention of leaving the Green Party of Canada. The idea of Elizabeth May leaving the Green Party is just wild.
Yes, were it not for the eccentricities of Andrew Weaver setting a precedent.
So all of that is happening. There's also statements that two-party execs are going to be stepping down early. It's disarray for a party that was looking pretty good after the last election.
Yeah, and there was, I think, definitely a feeling that Annamie Paul could build upon the beachhead established in 2019 and win her own seat and pick up maybe one or two others. I think at this point, a chance of that after the very likely election later this year, the Greens holding a seat in the Maritimes is looking pretty slight at the moment. Maybe they'll pick up one of the PEI ones, because they seem to have done well provincially there. But for the most part, that seems pretty unlikely. And it's not a great sign, even for a party that was just trying to add a third seat on Vancouver Island to be dealing with this.
And like, I flip back and forth on the question of Paul's leadership, because it looks on the one hand like it's been chaotic and marked by just internal dissent and just an inability to get it under control. On the other hand, I fully want to acknowledge that she's the first Black woman to be leader of a federal political party, and systemic racism infects every aspect of our society, and there is undoubtedly tensions within the Green Party. Not saying any individual in there is like an overt white nationalist or anything, but there are barriers put up for people of color. Jagmeet Singh has faced it. So I don't know what she's dealing with internally and how much she also has to deal with just the legacy of Elizabeth May that continues to float over the party, because she continues to be a sitting MP and just apparently will be that until the day she dies.
Definitely seems to be the trend on that. And this is maybe one of those things where not being in Parliament is causing problems. I seem to recall that in the period after winning the NDP leadership and actually winning the Burnaby by-election, that the NDP had quite a rocky time with Singh not in Parliament, and his leadership was troubled during that period. And I hardly think he's exactly lighting the world on fire now that he is in Parliament. It was definitely worse when he wasn't, and I'm wondering if the same effects hold here. It's just seems really hard to actually effectively run a party if you aren't in Parliament with your caucus.
And I think they both have had the same issues of being different enough from the previous leader on issues and substance that the internal party apparatus that had been built up around Tom Mulcair in one instance and Elizabeth May in the other, you know, they don't turn on a dime. And so you're suddenly facing an internal apparatus that is not necessarily in sync with you. And in both cases, it's not to say anyone's necessarily hostile, but there's just a challenge to start turning the ship in the direction you want to go.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of willpower.
It's also, leadership takes a fair bit of skill too, and there's a certain art to it as much as a science, and it's just hard to do it the more physical distance there is between you and the people you're trying to lead. And just being in the room as a leader gets results that an email or telephone call can't. And that is just, I think, one of the problems with just not being as involved in the day-to-day stuff in Ottawa.
And we're also in the middle of a pandemic, right? So even if
Paul
had won the York Centre by-election, Toronto Centre, whichever one she ran in, I forget now, if she had won that, she might still not be in Ottawa and she might still not see Atwin face-to-face, because Atwin, I imagine, has spent most of the pandemic zooming in from Fredericton, and Paul Manley probably from Nanaimo, because that's a long flight to have to take. I'm sure they have tried to make it in on occasion, but...
Yeah, I can't recall. I think the Fredericton Airport got shut down during the pandemic, too. It only does a few regional flights for the most part, and I think that may have gotten caught. So, yeah, it may actually just be a challenge getting to and from Fredericton on for Atwin.
So, very tough times to be the leader of a small political party, not helped by racial issues, not helped by the legacy issues, not helped by any of this.
Yeah, and the Israeli-Palestine stuff, that is an issue that tends to stir a lot of emotions in people, and it's rarely one I've seen anyone very effectively, dispassionately, and rationally discuss. That there's always a moral element to whatever side you're on that tends to make things particularly bitter when there's a disagreement. And that just makes navigating that tougher. But this does leave Paul in a pretty tough position. We talked at the time when she announced she was going to run in Ontario, and were somewhat skeptical of that decision. And that was when it looked like the Greens had a little wind in their sails and a little momentum post her winning the leadership, the three Greens more or less getting along and generally getting decent press when they were getting press at all. And with this, it's going to be a lot tougher to do that, particularly because the Greens have that perennial doubt hanging over them about viability. And it's one thing when you're half momentum and people can see that to assuage those fears. It's quite another when your party's shedding members, it's bad press after bad press, and you're trying to convince people to vote for a party that has never won in the province you're running in.
It's also awkward now, I'm realizing, that on the one hand, Elizabeth May does need to retire, but if she does, they're down to one incumbent MP.
Yeah.
So they both need that seat, but also need the fresh ideas, but...
What would have been best is that shortly after the leadership vote, for May to do the honorable thing that is often expected of MPs in a party in a safe seat, and that is the only thing that approaches a safe seat for the Greens, and step down to allow the new leader to run in a by-election, but that did not happen. And from the sounds of it, that was partly due to May's resistance to the idea.
I'm hopeful that the BC Liberals are taking notes, because this is a pretty good textbook case of what not to do following a leadership election. And
although at least with the BC Liberals, you have three sitting MLAs, at least with the BC Liberals, you either have the case of two sitting MLAs, a former cabinet minister who's generally well-respected within the party, and a person with fairly deep ties on the back and organizing side on there. So, and they all, for the most part, seem pretty cordial with each other. And it does not look like to me that there's going to be a huge kerfuffle when it comes to taking the reins of the party afterwards.
That's what it felt like when Andrew Wilkinson won, but yet the more we hear the follow-up from his leadership, the less competent it seemed to have been managed.
Well, so. From what I've heard on that generally I've heard has more to do with his particular idiosyncrasies and challenges when it comes to leadership and interpersonal relations more than a general willingness of the party to carry along. Especially because he did not really want to take the party in a new direction very much. He was... I don't think there was necessarily a continuity candidate in that race, because most of them pitched themselves as continuity candidates, but he was definitely in the continuity candidate camp.
Both the Greens at the federal level and the Liberals at the provincial level will need to be thinking about how they can shake themselves up and establish themselves as credible options for voters. Let's move on to quick takes. A historic deal has been reached between finance ministers of the G7 countries. This is actually pretty cool, good news. We are going to have a global minimum corporate tax rate of 15%, essentially an agreement between the most powerful economies in the world to say companies like Facebook and Google, you can't just keep moving your headquarters to wherever the taxes are lowest, because we are going to set a floor. It's not a very high floor, but it's a good start.
Yeah, so this is 15%, which is above Ireland's tax rate, but below any G7 corporate tax rate. So it hits that sweet spot of none of the parties have to adjust their taxes up, but it also basically discourages them from going to Ireland, which is typically the favorite place, or in weird Ireland-Netherlands combo that I don't fully understand, but apparently is the way a lot of companies do it.
I'm interested to see how they can get countries that aren't just the G7 on board. Like, obviously, the largest economies do have some clout, and I guess they'll bring it forward to the G20 to start bringing more countries on board. But getting rid of tax havens is always going to be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, and also, like, the G7 was the seven big nations at one point, but China isn't in there, so that got me madly down number two. I actually don't know where India ranks these days, but they're climbing pretty fast and they're not in there. You don't necessarily hit the same power that it used to, or the same share globally, but at least of the kind of... Wikipedia says liberal democracies, but India technically counts on that, so...
Worldometers.info says India is the fifth largest economy in the world.
Yeah, so there's definitely some path dependency on membership on this one. And, I mean, to be entirely honest, we probably shouldn't be there on a strict ranking basis. I'm glad we are, but we should also recognize that is in large part because the Americans wanted a friendly face when dealing with all the Europeans on there. But regardless, that's us, the US, Japan, the UK, that Germany, France. That's a pretty sizable block of economic power, Italy too, to bring together, and can definitely push things around quite a bit on that and leverage that ability or that size. Yeah, they might not, say, capture Apple's iPhone sales in certain countries, but definitely in a lot of the places it'll help them out on tax recovery. Yeah, but I said wait for that. So, moving on. The feds also announced this week that they're opening up a couple new immigration streams for Hong Kongers who want to come to Canada. This is in the aftermath of China basically effectively tearing up the agreement that governed Hong Kong's economy and preserved certain political rights in Hong Kong that now has been overridden and now makes it easier for certain people from Hong Kong to come to Canada. This follows a British policy that I think dates back to January this year, where they opened their doors up to political refugees from Hong Kong. For us, it's a little more limited to two main streams, who are Hong Kongers working in Canada or recent graduates from Hong Kong living in Canada. I'm happy to see this. I wish it was a lot broader than just that. I'd be happy to see us just have a fairly low bar open doors policy when it comes to political refugees from the Chinese authoritarianism.
So this is an interesting one for me. Like, I'm largely supportive of more immigration, more pathways, making it easier. And so this is great on that side. It needs to be placed in political context, right? This is trying to find a way to signal dissatisfaction with the policies of the Chinese government without, like, really putting our own country at risk in any way. So it's like trying to support dissidents in Hong Kong, which I'm supportive of that as well. But it's also, in a way, it's like saying to Spain, like, we'll support Catalonian immigrants through a new process that's not available to other Spanish immigrants. Like, the situation's
different.
There are a lot of other political refugees around the world who don't, like, this is clearly a very targeted political move in terms of geopolitics.
Yeah, it is. I think a more apt analogy would be, I guess, if Spain took possession of Gibraltar and then reneged on its agreements during the handover, but...
Or Sikh farmers trying to flee India right now, for example, and just going for people coming from the Punjab region, like targeting one region of India for immigration to Canada because they're fleeing Modi.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a geopolitical element to it, but it is also a fairly significant one, both because I think the relationship with China is going to be the primary foreign policy question of the next half century, and not just for us, but for pretty much every liberal democratic country in the world. And also because, as a part of that, this is the precursor event of effectively disregarding the agreement that China and the UK signed regarding the handover does influence that quite a bit and the reading of it.
Turning back to Canada and our own ugly past as a bit of a follow-up to last week's episode and our discussion of the graves in Kamloops at the residential school, the NDP brought forward a motion demanding Trudeau and the federal government halt what they called belligerent court fights with Indigenous kids and survivors of residential schools. In the past, the government has made settlements and reached court decisions that have recognized the harms caused to people who stayed at residential schools overnight. They have done a settlement with survivors of what were called day schools, but there were still a few groups left out of some of these other settlements, namely survivors who attended residential schools at day but went home at night, a certain specific class. And so there was this class action lawsuit ongoing with the federal government, and the NDP said, why don't you stop fighting in residential school survivors in court? The motion went before Parliament, and I'm very pleased to say every MP who voted in favor of it, This includes Conservatives, Bloc, Greens, and Liberal backbenchers. Cabinet abstained from this, and I think that was reasonable because it doesn't really make sense for the government to weigh in on its own legal strategy. They couldn't really say, we're against doing what we're doing. And the following day, I think it was, or maybe the day after that, the government announced they had reached a settlement with those survivors. And so they had stopped suing. They had stopped fighting survivors and kids in court and had reached a settlement that each of those survivors will get $10,000 and the government will invest $50 million in a what were called Day Scholars, a Day Scholars Revitalization Fund. So it's a settlement, so both sides are happy with it. So I won't criticize it as not being enough, but it's good to see the government stop this lawsuit.
Yeah, I don't want to say it's necessarily good news just because the context is so horrible, but it's definitely a move in the right direction. I think both the power that a unanimous motion acknowledging the abstention, of course, carries and the subsequent settlement.
And I'm not sure if other cases are ongoing. I know there are some specific cases around the release of records of specific residential schools that are still being that were being fought up until at least a couple of weeks ago. Some of that stuff definitely needs to be sorted out. We need transparency. We need truth before we can get reconciliation. And so this gives me optimism. We talked about that last week, right? Have we reached a turning point, or is it just another round of words? If this is a sign, I would say it's hopefully more of a turning point than just empty words. Lots more to dig into, including the report that came out today from the representative of children and youth in BC, Dr. Jennifer Charlesworth, who looked at the legacy and the life and untimely death of a young woman named Skye, who died of an overdose on her 17th birthday in August 2017. The report's called Skye's Legacy. Skye was an Indigenous teen in the care of the BC government, and she was taken from her mom at 5, moved 15 times in 12 years, had 18 different social workers across 8 foster homes, and was in 8 different schools. And the report is pretty damning of the child welfare system, as so many of these are. It says it left her without a sense of belonging, and that the province was more concerned with finding her a permanent adoptive home than trying to return her to her mother or extended family. Like, Indigenous Kids in Care has been described as the new residential school. Like, it's a continuation in many ways of intentional and indirect policies that rip families apart. And these reports need more. Like, this isn't the first report to look at something like this, but it's, and it probably won't be the last, but these are reports that need to be listened to. And these, oh, they're tragic to think about.
Yeah, it really is. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done here, but in both improving the welfare system and doing a bunch of the work to resolve the harms, because part of what makes this kind of self-perpetuating is that kind of intergenerational damage does also sometimes make it so it's not great for the child to be left in the care either of their family member, which puts it in a really horrible position, because you don't want to have to break that up, but at the same time there's the competing interests there. So the work needs to be done on both improving the child welfare when the children are separated and preventing the separation in the first place. And that involves helping improve the conditions that lead to that.
I think this report is pretty valuable for highlighting some of those exact issues, like the fact that Skye was taken from her home wasn't necessarily the wrong thing, but she didn't have a stable home after that. And the fact that the province did not try to uphold Skye's wishes, like this child, this young girl, wanted to connect with her culture. She wanted to go visit her home territory of the Tlingit Gwich'in Band in Northwest Territories. And as far as the representative reports, those wishes were not even attempted to be accommodated. Beyond that, the focus, if you can't bring this child back to their parents or their mother and their father or their whatever that family unit looks like, there's always extended family that at least keeps them close to grandparents or uncles, aunts, etc., that can at least keep them close to their upbringing in their culture. And
yeah, and even if they're, for whatever reason, a change of guardianship there isn't suitable, at least effort should be made to continue that cultural connection and facilitate that as much as possible.
And so the report comes with a series of recommendations. The top lines are a renewed analysis of what's needed to look after Indigenous, including Métis youth in care, and to make the investments to achieve that by April of next year. More updates to care planning and case management standards so people aren't falling through the cracks like this. And like moving around is just a lot for a child. And to do that so many times in such a short period just destroys their ability to grow up and just to have that stability. Finally, the report needs to be shared with social workers and anyone who's caring with youth and has to and get them to engage with this and really understand what the children in these situations are going through. And so the government hasn't fully committed to enacting these recommendations because they involve spending, and so they want time to review and to make sure they can afford it. But I hope they take this seriously and look at these issues because children.
Well, in a somewhat more positive child care story, the BC government is moving forward on two new pieces of legislation related to child care in BC. So there's a Early Childhood Educators Act, as well as an Early Learning and Child Care Act going forward that were introduced today or last couple of days.
Might have been yesterday.
Might have been yesterday.
They all blend together.
What is even time in the pandemic?
So the Early Learning and Child Care Act is a bill to bring together the existing Child Care BC Act and the Child Care Subsidy Act. It's a way to really move forward some of the funding for childcare, including Indigenous-led childcare, which is something I meant to bring up in the last news story, is really moving many of these systems to Indigenous leadership is another recommendation that's come forward regularly. And so I'm pleased to see efforts to ensure Indigenous-led childcare is in here. The big thing I think in this bill, though, are the requirement that the government has to produce annual reports on how far it's getting in its goal of achieving inclusive universal childcare, and new regulations that allow the government to set caps on fees for childcare. And so those two tools will, one, help provide some more transparency, and we can get to in a second how difficult that has been to date, and also make it easier for government to say, all right, today's childcare is worth $1,500 for you a month. Next year, it'll be $1,300. In a couple years, it'll be, I guess they want to get to $10 a day, $200 a month by 2027, based on their 10-year plan. So maybe they'll have to go a little faster, but they can start setting caps. And along with some of the other efforts, hopefully that gets us to the promise. And the reports will tell us if we're getting there. Hopefully.
Hopefully. Journalist Rob Shaw noted this week that the government's actually ended up creating a pretty complicated system in the attempt to roll this out that has made it very hard to actually just track how the government is doing between all the various pilot projects, mix of space types, various programs to reduce caps or reduce fees or put caps on that. And as a result, it's just hard for the people whose job it is to hold the government to account to actually do so.
Well, and you get announcements like, oh, there's 26,000 spaces being funded. And you're like, does that mean they exist right now? And the answer is like, some of them, yes. Others are being built. And we could find the exact data. We've had this conversation pretty thoroughly in the Slack, but it is a convoluted system. And Shaw, to his credit, acknowledges it could be by design or just a simply a byproduct of the approach the government is taking, where they're trying to reduce fees as much as they can in the interim as they get this bigger system going. The key to remember is this was always going to be a 10-year plan, because when Quebec tried to roll out their universal childcare system, they went really fast, really hard, and had immediate capacity issues where they did not have enough ECEs trained. They did not have enough childcare spaces. So it was suddenly like just a lottery system of who got in. And that didn't really support families right away. And so we're trying to avoid that. But at the same time, we're also trying to bring everyone's fees down so most people qualify for the fee reduction initiative. But then there's also some pilot projects, like he mentions. Those are the, I think, 6,000 kids who have $10 a day. And we can learn as we expand those daycares out. And then we're also trying to do things like bring ECE wages up. And that brings us in a second to the Early Childhood Educators Act, where we're also trying to professionalize it and create more academic streams for ECEs. So it's a complicated realm of policy. I find it really interesting in many ways, and also very personally, it affects me directly, but we're getting there. The question is, are we getting there as fast as people need? Many people will say no, of course.
Yeah, and the Liberals have been harping on that a bit of late. I've seen them do a fair bit of actual kind of social media, and there might have even been an email to that from the party to that effect, trying to push on it. And although, don't quote me on that, because I cannot recall off the top of my head. But yeah, it's not clear to me how much that's going to really land. And just in general, I'm not sure the Liberals have really found a coherent position on this, or just in general. And like, one of the problems that I'm hopefully the leadership race will resolve, just what's the point of the Liberals? Because in the last election, and kind of both leading up to it and afterwards, they really seem to be more acting as just the auditors to whatever, or attempting to be, to whatever the NDP is doing, without having much of a coherent vision of what they actually want out of government.
And meanwhile, you get the health critic releasing, or meanwhile, you get the health critic of the party sponsoring petitions calling for mask mandates to be removed from schools because they violate autonomy and make it hard for children to have freedom. Like, it's just, Merrifield's just embarrassing at this point.
And why go on that when there's, you should be critical of what, of say the Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions that Rob Shaw had a piece in the Orca this week on, and it turns out they're basically just like a minister and a few staffers that don't actually run any programs. Like, this would be something that there is a very viable line of attack on this, particularly since the NDP liked to trot out that they created this ministry every time they get criticized on, well, either mental health or particularly issues related to the overdose crisis. And yet, like, basically seem to have slipped under the radar for a couple years now at this point on that, which is just weird, and you got to wonder what the opposition's doing.
Yeah. Shaw's piece is interesting. He points out the budget of the ministry is a paltry $13 million, largely going to 83 staff, including political staff, but every ministry would have some political staff. The ministry's a weird one, as you say. I'd be curious to dig more into this, but I'm conscious of time. Like, it could still be valuable, even if 83 is not just a handful. It's a significant number of people. And if their primary accomplishment is improving the effectiveness of the Ministry of Health in delivering mental health services, which is where they still seem to be sitting, and improving policy outcomes, that could be pretty meaningful, but given the overdose numbers we're still seeing.
Yeah, and it's not
clear, could be doing more.
It's also not clear in that case why having them hived off into a separate ministry is any real benefit. I mean, just take the 30,000 foot view here. The point of ministers in responsible government is to be accountable for their ministries and the actions that are taken and the programs that are put in place, and to provide a layer of political accountability to that. But if all the programs are actually just run out of the Ministry of Health, and this ministry basically turns into an advisory or research group, effectively, rather than an actual program delivery ministry, the effect of that is to basically obscure the lines of accountability and responsibility there. Because if the programs are Ministry of Health delivered, then the Minister of Health is the responsible party, in which case, what is the point of having a person whose job it is to be the responsible party to the legislature? Just from a function of government point of view in our system, it's confusing and obscuring.
Do you remember in 2015 when Justin Trudeau named everyone a minister because he didn't want to have second-tier people, but I think it also helped him reach his gender quota of 50-50?
No, the problem, I remember that. The problem was that he initially didn't do that, and we're counting the ministers of state as part of the cabinet for the gender balance thing, until someone actually took a look at the numbers and realized that most of the ministers of state were women, which was, the junior minister level. And then it suddenly got real embarrassing and everyone got bumped up to full minister.
We're just an amazingly effective country. To just round off the childcare stuff, the Early Childhood Educators Act, I just want to mention, does a bunch of things to really promote early childhood educators. It's going to reform some of the regulations around post-secondary programs. There's going to be a public registry of ECEs and ECE programs. There'll be title protection for ECEs, which means only people who have achieved the certificate can call themselves an early childhood educator, much the same way engineers or geoscientists or doctors, I believe, can only use those titles.
Yeah, just to be clear, it's not who are registered with the governing body in this case. I'm not sure if it's a certificate or not. Just the academic qualifications alone don't get you there.
I have an engineering degree, but I am not a qualified professional engineer. I could be, but I'd have to upgrade a bunch of stuff and pay fees that I don't want to. So good to see movement on childcare. Hope to see substance from Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions. Let's close in Ontario. Doug Ford, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, so the big constitutional news this week is we have another notwithstanding clause usage, which is something that seems to be happening more and more often. In this case, it's related to the Ontario government's legislation around third-party advertising rules and the limitation periods. And this has been an evolving area of Canadian elections law, because as we've moved to more of a fixed election date system, it's changed the logic of advertising around that and basically effectively turns the preceding 12 months or so leading up to an election into a extended campaign period, which has, as a result, led to, I think, a lot more third-party advertising in that case. And you've seen various governments try and address that to varying degrees. I think BC, when they brought in their recent, or I guess it's 2017, so it's not recent anymore, when they updated their election laws, they had some pre-writ stuff they added to that. It's a pretty common thing here. But anyway, this comes out of a decision or a court decision related to a conservative bill that they brought in that extended the limitation period from 6 months to 12 months. keeping the same election cap or spending cap of $600,000. This was challenged. I think this was just a lower court decision. It wasn't even appealed up.
Yeah, I believe it's the Superior Court of Ontario. The key thing there being that court can still strike it down. Like, Ontario could appeal, but then they'd also have to motion to put a stay on that ruling if they wanted to keep this spending limit in place until the election, which is now less than a year away, in place.
Yeah, so that
by throwing the notwithstanding clause out there, he can do both.
Yeah,
he can continue to appeal it and restrict people's speech.
If you're notwithstanding clause, you don't even need to appeal it because that bypasses the whole thing. But yeah, so anyway, they announced they were going to bring in the notwithstanding clause to overrule this decision, and that caused everything to just explode in the discourse.
Yeah, because it's a ridiculous reaction. So the case is even dumber than that. There is a helpful Twitter thread posted in our Slack, and I'll try and make sure the link is in the show notes. But effectively, the initial lawsuit around the spending limit was not even over the 12-month limit. It was over the 6-month limit that existed before, and that may have even come from a Kathleen Wynne bill. I'm not totally sure. So that was being challenged. Ontario had filed evidence to justify a 6-month restriction, but then when oral hearings were heard, they'd already upped it to 12 months. So now they had to change their arguments to say, oh, actually 12 months is a more reasonable restriction. And so the court had to look at this evidence and go, all right, you said a 6-month limit is reasonable, and you've also said a 12-month limit is reasonable. So in terms of a minimal impairment on freedom of expression, clearly a 6-month limit is where I should draw the line just on this. The judge didn't even have to decide whether a 6-month limit was reasonable. It was just clear that a 12-month limit is less reasonable than a 6-month one. So the law got struck down because Doug Ford is bad at legislation and courts.
Yeah, they weren't super strategic on this. I think it is worth pausing for a moment to remark on the fact that this kind of inverts the typical partisan alignments when it comes to election financing laws, which has led to some really unusual positions where people who are generally anti-big money in politics are going against Ford on this one and vice versa. So that just has led to so much incoherence in the whole thing.
A complicated issue. So I'm glad that we have pretty much reached a political consensus across the spectrum in this country that political parties should be subject to spending limits. Like, we don't want American-style limitless spending where it just gets out of control. We can have debates over how much those numbers should be, but I think most Canadians are pretty happy with where they happen to be in most cases. Like, our parties aren't blowing hundreds of millions of dollars every year trying to convince us of their positions. The challenge now comes up, as we're alluding to, that you have third parties, whether they're environmental groups, charities, nonprofits, or unions, or in some cases, groups like, or corporations, or groups like Ontario Proud, who are actually spending a significant amount of money.
Yeah, a fair bit of the reason why Ford extended this out is because in Ontario politics, in the third-party advertising space, the big players are the public sector union, and particularly the teachers union, and it's been a perennial source of annoyance and complaint that every time there's an election, the Conservatives get hit with a raft of third-party advertising that is disproportionate in scope compared to what their side or aligned interests generally manage to put out. And part of that is the of center funders are actually, unlike the U.S., tend to be pretty cheap in a lot of ways and don't put as much money into this. But it generally is just created the situation where third-party advertising in Ontario is very much not a friend of the PCs in general. So they're moving to limit that in a way that makes a fair bit of sense just in terms of how they want to minimize their risks in election. Which
in term isn't go ahead.
Yeah. Which like isn't great, particularly if when you're using the constitutional nuclear option on, and that is where I'm the most concerned on this, because generally I don't have a problem with fairly extensive third party advertising limits in the lead up to elections, including over fairly significant periods, for the very reason that because of the fixed election laws, you effectively have a very long campaign period in practice that the older laws didn't really recognize, but operated nonetheless. And I mean, the notwithstanding clause has always been controversial, but it is probably, all things being equal, good to have an option where the final decision is ultimately with a democratically accountable body rather than not. But in order to maintain that, it does need to be used sparingly and only as absolutely necessary.
And using it like right in the lead up to an election to try to tilt the rules arguably in your favor looks crass, opportunistic, and counter to what you're arguing
for. Yeah, I'm sure the I'm very certain the conservatives view this as leveling the playing field rather than tilting things in their favor, but that's one of those in the eye of the beholder things. But yeah, it's not great. It's not as bad as the preemptive uses that's become common in Quebec, which is, I think, particularly worrisome, because you should at least have that judicial review, and if ultimately the democratically accountable people think that the court got it wrong in a fundamental way, there maybe should be a way to change that, but preemptive use is not great, or particularly worrisome.
I could talk about this for a long time, but I'll just close with I'm very interested in seeing where this goes and seeing what happens in Ontario, but in particular, the legal aspect of it, the notwithstanding clause, I think a lot of people forget, doesn't apply to the entire charter. It only covers sections 2, which are your fundamental freedoms, and 7 through 15, your legal and equality rights. There are, when it comes to a case like this, a lot of rights read in through section 3, your democratic rights, your right to vote, and some of the past cases, including Harper v. Canada of Stephen Harper fame, which actually looked at the legitimacy of some of the spending limits, and it upheld some, but it didn't necessarily say they are always guaranteed to pass. And so there is a possibility that a different angle could be taken on Ford's law and saying that restricting third parties does limit too far, does limit people's ability to engage in an election. I'll be watching for that. I don't know if that's going to be a winning argument. I don't imagine courts like attempts to skirt the notwithstanding clause, but it's a fascinating area of law for me.
Yeah, I'm really not too sure how the courts view that once the notwithstanding clause has been a vote. The only other thing I'll say on this, we don't have really time to explore it too much because we're running a little long already, but in relation to the concerns around the notwithstanding clause I voiced earlier, I do think another area of concern when it comes to the courts and just policymaking in general, which this case here touches on, is that increasingly in Canada, particularly at the federal level, it seems, decisions are getting offloaded to the courts, and this has generally been a problem of all governing parties not wanting to take hard stances in part, partly for other reasons, but it's not super great to, I think, increasingly move policymaking out of the legislative and into the courtroom. And I don't know, maybe this is a sign of things starting to rebalance a bit on it, I'm not super hopeful on that for some of the reasons we mentioned earlier, but it is, I think, an area of ongoing concern with just in the general Canadian policy making and legal space.
Politicians should have some guts, but not such that they throw the notwithstanding clause around anytime they don't get their way in court. That's the concluding lesson here.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.